Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Revelations of sexual abuse of children by clerics have rocked the Catholic Church around the world and shaken the faith of the faithful in the very people that have traditionally looked for they've looked to for guidance and as representatives of God on earth. In the United States, the church has paid out millions of dollars as the result of lawsuits brought by victims of the abuse. It has also resulted in Catholic dioceses around the nation releasing the names of clergy who have been accused of sexual misconduct with minors. The Charlotte Diocese has yet to do so, though they have promised to release a list of those credibly accused by the end of this year. WFAE has been exploring the history of this abuse scandal, the significance of these lists, and what victims hope to gain from the release of these names in a four-part podcast simply titled The List.
It's not about what the Catholic Church wants. It's not about what Bishop Jugish wants. It's about protecting kids and about protecting not only kids, but any parishioner who was victimized by any member of the clergy.
That's the type of list sexual abuse survivors are waiting for from the Charlotte Catholic Diocese. In a statement released in May 2019, Bishop Peter Jugis said the diocese was committed to releasing a list of clergy who have been, quote, credibly accused of sexual abuse involving minors.
I remember he telling me, don't tell anybody about this. And this is, I did this because I love you. And this is how God wants us to show each other that we love each other.
And time is running out for the Charlotte Diocese to meet that deadline. And people are waiting.
That's the voice of podcast host Sarah D'Elia, who spoke with survivors, lawyers, a watchdog group, and the Charlotte Diocese itself to get answers to questions like, who decides what a credible accusation is, why this kind of list is important to survivors, and how an accusation is reviewed? Among other questions. And Sarah D'Elia joins us now. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Mike.
Good to see you. And also with us is Thomas Doyle, an inactive Catholic priest and former attorney in the Vatican Embassy in Washington, D.C. He was one of the first people in the Catholic Church to bring attention to sexual abuse by clergy with a report he published in 1985. And he joins us this morning from a very early San Diego. Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Later in the program, we'll hear from a survivor of abuse, and I want to stress, we invited a representative from the Catholic Diocese of Charlotte to be a part of this discussion. They declined, citing scheduling conflicts, and if you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Before we start talking about your four-part podcast, which is available right now wherever podcasts are sold, which is what I like to say, because they're free. And before we start talking about the list of names that the diocese says they will release shortly, are we to assume that any names that might appear on that list are names of people who allegedly might have done something wrong in the past? Are there any current names on that list, or do we know?
That's a great question, and I think the safest way to answer that question is to say that we do not know, since there is not a list that is published. The diocese has said that, for all intents and purposes, that the abuse is not ongoing in the church today, and that most of the abuse that they're looking at in a historical review they're conducting right now, dating back to files from 1972 when the diocese formed in Charlotte, that most of the allegations are older and not current.
In your dealings with the I keep calling them the archdiocese. They're not. The Catholic Diocese of Charlotte. How have you found them to be? Have they been forthcoming? Have they been easy to work with? Are they playing things close to the vest?
Well, it's interesting because there's no current spokesperson for the diocese. So David Haynes, a former reporter in Charlotte and a spokesperson for the diocese, retired from that position, I believe, in April of this year. So there's no official person to kind of run your questions by. We have been running them by the diocese. We've been inviting the diocese to come on this program, to be a part of the podcast, and they have responded to requests via email. But as far as getting somebody in person to kind of just describe more of the processes that we're interested in learning more about, they've declined those interviews.
Some of the dioceses around the country that have released these lists they go back years because they've been in existence. The Catholic Diocese of Charlotte was started in 1972. So that's where their list, when they put it out, that's where they will begin. Is that right?
That's my understanding.
In the absence of this list, would it be correct to say that we knew that abuse occurred here because of victims coming forward and from lists of priests from other dioceses who may have worked here at some point in time?
That's correct. So a lot of what we've been able to discover is through court documents and court records that are all public. Anyone can go look at them at the courthouse and see allegations, some that have been led to settlements with the diocese and some that have been dismissed. And also, Mike, it's a really good point. Other lists that have been released from other dioceses have been very enlightening to things that have gone on in Charlotte or people who have been in Charlotte but gone on to abuse other people in other churches.
Are we to assume that without this list, do we have any idea exactly how extensive abuse may have been here in terms of being a problem? I mean, we know of certain people who have already been dealt with in this area, but is that an indication of how deep this might have gone?
So I would say the list is crucial to have an organized, easy to understand way for the not only parishioners, but the public to understand how deep this abuse goes on. The Catholic News Herald, which is the paper of the diocese in Charlotte, they do, since 2002, they say that they do publish articles relating to allegations, credible allegations against priests within the Charlotte diocese. But as far as having a place where people can go and understand credible accusations that have come forward from 1972 to the present day, that does not exist right now.
This scandal and news about this scandal has been going on for so long. I'm surprised we're having this conversation today. But 146 out of 178 dioceses have already released their lists of priests they say have been accused of sexual abuse of minors. Why is Charlotte so late to the game?
That is a great question, and I would love a little more clarity on that question because, you know, we don't have a current spokesperson for the diocese right now, but you do look at statements from David Haynes where at one point he did tell the Charlotte Observer, I believe it was in January 2019, that there was no empirical evidence that releasing a list like this was helpful in the healing of victims. Then he's also told other outlets like WSOC-TV that they weren't sure if it was fair to release a list because of being fair to people who had passed away that had accusations against them.
But Tom Doyle is with us, a former Catholic priest and an active Catholic priest who released the first indication to the church itself of sexual abuse of priests in 1985. Here it is, 2019, and Charlotte has not released its lists of priests. Can you explain it, Tom?
Well, I can give you an estimate or a guess. I think they've refused to release the list because they want to, number one, avoid further embarrassment. One of the tendencies all over the Catholic Church, U.S. and elsewhere, is the major problem of secrecy, which hangs over the church like a black or gray cloud all the time. And one of the issues I'm certain that they're concerned about is letting more of the secrets out. The remarks you just mentioned about that releasing the list won't help anybody, that's total nonsense. You know, that's ridiculous. The people in the institutional church, the bishops and the other people in so-called leadership, really, you know, I've been involved in this for 35 years, and they haven't changed all that much as far as their sensitivity and awareness of the incredible damage that this has done to individual victims, to their families, and to the people who had believed in the church in general. And one of the issues that I've been aware of as long as I've been involved in this is that the number one priority for the institution, by that I mean the hierarchy, the bishops, is themselves. If it wasn't, we wouldn't be talking this morning. If the children, the victims, were the first priority, this would have been taken care of in a sense. It would have been attacked or confronted much more effectively years ago. But in all the years I've been involved, the common denominator has been damage control, cover up, denial, And now that they're forced to do something because of events that have taken place, especially in the past 2 years, it's a scramble to figure out how we can, you know, save as much ground as we can.
Your investigation into this and your resulting report came out in 1985, but surely this did not begin in the 21st or the 25th or the 20th century with the church. This goes back, how long do you think it goes back?
Well, I know how long it goes back because I've done significant research and over the years. And in 2006, two other colleagues and I published a book called Sex, Priests, and Secret Codes. And in spite of the kind of flashy title, what it actually is an historical presentation of the issue of sexual abuse of minors by clergy based on the church's own documentation. So the earliest credible documentation goes to the year 98 AD. And by then, at that time, you know, there weren't any popes or hierarchy or Vatican or anything else. The church was basically set up as, It was groups of believers who met in homes, and the leadership was the elders. They were generally married men and who were selected by the group as the one who they thought was most apt to be the elder. And they issued, somebody wrote a small book called in English it's called The Teaching of the 12 Apostles. And the second chapter says quite clearly that men shall not become sexually involved with young boys. It was written in Greek, I believe. Original language. So that's the earliest. The first actual law, church law, dates from the year 309. The group of bishops got together in a Spanish town called Elvira, and they created the first actual church laws, or canon laws as they're called, to deal with issues in their communities. And one of them was sexual impropriety between anyone, but also between clergy or bishops and priests and young people. So that's the first actual law. Since then, there's a string that goes down to the present day.
So this has been going on since nearly the
constant.
Constantly, since the very beginning. Why is it just in 1985 or shortly there in that neighborhood that we've just now begun to hear about this? Is it simply because people have finally started coming forward? And if so, why didn't they come forward in 1895 or in 1776 or in 1542?
Well, there is some historical evidence, not a great deal because it's just not available, of people coming forward in different periods. It has been known, it's been publicly known in the church that clerics have violated children. That's a topic for a whole other long conversation of the nature of that evidence. But it exploded, so to speak, in our country in 1985, mm-hmm. 84 actually. A priest in a diocese in Louisiana, Lafayette, Louisiana, had been sexually abusing children since he was ordained, and he had been covered up by the bishop. He'd been shifted from one place to another. And finally it reached critical mass, and I think two or three families were just fed up.
Yeah.
And there were some death threats involved. But they confronted the church, and the bishop entered into a confidential agreement with, I believe, six families. They give a bunch of money, and they'd sign these agreements to never talk about it, so it would remain secret. But one family pulled out, got a lawyer, and it went public.
And we have to stop there. Tom Doyle is a former priest and former attorney at the Vatican Embassy who investigated this in 1985. Sarah DeLee is also here, the host of the List podcast. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about sexual abuse in the Catholic Church because by the end of this year, we are told, the Catholic Diocese of Charlotte will be releasing a list of names of priests who have been, in their words, credibly accused of this activity with minors. It's the subject of a four-part podcast that WFAE has produced and hosted by WFAE's Sarah D'Elia, who is with us this morning in the studio. Thomas Doyle is an inactive Catholic priest whose investigation was the first of this activity in the Catholic Church in America. He released it in 1985, and he's a former attorney in the Vatican Embassy. Later on in the program, we'll hear from a victim. And we invited the members of the Catholic Diocese to be on this program today for this discussion, but they declined, citing scheduling conflicts. In one of the episodes of the List podcast, a Charlotte psychologist, Mike Yankovic, pointed out the power differential between the abuser and the abused.
One of the real important things here is the realization that almost all kids know their abusers, and that majority of kids are being hurt by someone that's trusted. So if that's the case, that means that if anyone has ever had any kind of problematic behaviors with kids, they must be taken out of that circumstance, and they must get a very focused, intensive treatment and are held accountable to their behavior, not by their inside group, but by outside forces. And we can't know, my opinion, whether it means they can ever be back to working with kids. But what I am sure of is that there should be no stone left unturned in ever thinking about letting in their kids, and certainly not in any way the way the Catholic Church has done it, certainly in the last bunch of years, but truth be told, has always done it that way.
That's an interesting point, Tom Dole, because until recently, when church leaders took action, it's my understanding that when they took action, they sometimes just shuffled these men around the country and put them in other parishes or in other situations, and still in proximity to children, and maybe in some cases working with children. How do you explain that? Why, when these allegations come up, haven't they simply been removed from that environment or removed from the priesthood altogether? I'm sorry, I'm supposed to restate the question?
Hello?
Hello, Tom, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Did you want me? Oh, are we back on?
Yes, we are.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
Did you hear the question, or do I need to repeat it?
Why don't you repeat it?
Okay. Until recently, when facts came up about certain individuals who may have been accused credibly of abusing children, they moved these priests around the country. And they put them sometimes back into situations where they would have access and be in proximity to children. Why did they do that? Why didn't they put them in situations where they didn't have access or simply remove them from the priesthood?
Well, that's not too complicated an answer to give you. They did that first because their primary concern was their own image and themselves. They were not primarily concerned about the victims, about the children. Secondly, I don't really, from all of my experience, believe that they really completely understand, or even understand in an adequate manner, the damage that sexual violation does to a human being. And it's damage that's lifelong. Whether these events happened 20 years ago, 40 years ago, or last week, the damage is the damage. So they've covered up consistently and historically, including the diocese you're in, excuse me, and they've, you know, rather than do something significant, they haven't really, well, I think they know how bad this is, but their primary concern is their own image. So,
Sarah, I guess in the 20th century, in the 19th and the 18th and the 17th century, the church was a closed group, and they took care of each other amongst themselves. Not a lot of information from inside got out, it would seem to me. But since the scandal has reared its ugly head, not only in this country but around the world, why is it that the church is still policing itself? Why is it that we're waiting for the Catholic Diocese of Charlotte to release a list of credibly accused priests? Why isn't a prosecutor in there going through the files and digging up information and compiling their own list?
I have wondered that question myself, and I think it's a really...
If this had happened here, if it had happened at the Bank of America, That's what would happen.
Sure. If, you know, I think when it's in episode 2 when Tom Doyle and I speak, he made a really interesting point that when someone is accused of murder, we know about it. It's out there in the public. But it doesn't seem to follow the same rules when someone is accused of sexual abuse historically in the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church is not the police. They're not a city agency. They're not someone I could send a FOIA, a Freedom of Information Act request to. So there is this secrecy that is behind it.
The Catholic Church is not the only church in which this has occurred.
Absolutely.
This has occurred in Baptist churches and others. And I don't want to pick on churches because it's just, that's not fair.
Right.
But it's happened. So when it's happened in those other denominations, what has been the approach? Have they investigated themselves or did law enforcement come in?
I'm not really sure about that.
All right.
I can speak to that.
Okay.
Excuse me. I've been involved in several other denominations, and the tendency of most of them, I can't say all because I don't know about all, but the tendency of the ones I've been involved in has been to cover up, to lie, and to protect the leadership or the top level. Somehow, churches, organized religious bodies, seem to have the delusional idea that they're above confrontation, they're above the law, they're above accountability. And that's the colossal example, of course, is the Roman Catholic Church. And the question you asked is very good. There should be civil officials walking up to the door with a warrant and saying, step aside, we're taking your files, we're going to check this out ourselves, because you can't do it.
Why aren't they?
Well, in many states they are.
Finally.
That's what happened, for example, in the state of Pennsylvania. The Attorney General moved in and had a grand jury investigation. Now, this started about 2 years ago, and it's over. And they published a huge report in July of 1985 that was a bit mind-blowing, but it was honest and accurate. And it showed from the investigation of the six of the, well, they actually, there were grand jury investigations in every one of the eight Catholic dioceses in Pennsylvania, coming up with the same type of information, cover-up, lying, horrific things done to the victims, priests being shuffled around, priests being, let off the hook, never facing accountability until there's a force from outside.
Yeah.
And that's the only thing that has changed this.
These acts are, in fact, criminal. And to protect the perpetrators of these acts from law enforcement seems to be heinous and immoral on the surface, and even more so when it comes from a bastion of what purports to be a bastion of morality, which would be a church, not just the Catholic Church. In episode 2 of the List podcast, Father Patrick Winslow, the Vicar General of the Catholic Diocese of Charlotte, the second in command to Peter Jugis, who's the bishop, emphasized that turning perpetrators over to law enforcement is, in fact, the policy now.
First, we notify civil authorities. Second, we engage in an internal process, which features a review board. The review board comes together from different disciplines that would be expert in investigating these matters and looks into the question of credibility and comes to a conclusion as to whether or not this allegation has the semblance of truth. Meantime, the moment the allegation comes forward, any clergy is set on administrative leave pending the outcome of the review board, report's investigation into the matter and finding of credibility. The moment an allegation is found credible, it's reported to the bishop, and he acts on their recommendations.
How long has that been policy in the Catholic Diocese of Charlotte, Sarah?
To me, it's a little unclear, because we do have a statement from an interview that David Haynes, the former spokesperson for the Charlotte Diocese, gave within the last year, saying that the policy was to report accusations, concerns to the Department of Social Services. So, at least from where I'm standing, it is a little unclear as to when that policy was instated.
And did Father Winslow tell you what actions are taken on these recommendations that he spoke of? Because they have a review board.
Right.
They look into the allegations. They either find that person guilty or not guilty, or credibly accused or not credibly accused. What happens then?
Yeah, I think so. One thing the diocese would probably point out if they were here is that finding an accusation as credible, quote unquote, is not an admission of guilt. So they're not saying that person is guilty. It's saying that that incident more than likely occurred, and that there's evidence to back that up. So the review board, which is comprised of lay people in the church, there is one clergy member on the board right now. It's made up of 11 people. They have an investigator. They do their investigation. I can't say much more than that because I didn't get a chance to interview anybody from the board. And then they make their recommendation to Bishop Peter Jugis, and then he would act on their recommendation.
Did they refuse to talk to you, or did you just not get a chance to talk to them?
They declined my interview request.
Okay. When you spoke with Father Patrick Winslow, he told you that they hired an independent investigative firm to do an historical review of files dating back to the beginning of the diocese in 1972. That means going through, he said, thousands of pages.
It's an enormous task to go through so many files in the archives. But the people that have been entrusted with the responsibility are professional, they're qualified, they're making amazing progress. We're going to do everything that we can to make sure that all those files can be updated with current information, because these things go back so many decades. People may be deceased. People may have taken action in the past, and it's important to make sure that they're updated. And so it's not just the finding of the files that have an allegation, but also making sure that the proper research is done to bring it up to date.
Every other diocese in the country had similar numbers of files to go through, perhaps more particularly in places like Boston, where there is an enormous Catholic population and the diocese dates back centuries. Why have they been able to do it and we have not?
I think it comes back to, from the interviews and the research I've been able to do, is what is a priority for the diocese. And the diocese has said in the past, through a spokesperson, David Haynes, who no longer works there, that they aren't convinced that having a list like this is important for victims or the healing. So I think if they had, since then, they've obviously had a change of heart. They've said in May 2019 that they're committed to releasing a list by the end of the year. So something has changed in their way of thinking. I think also the added pressure of so many dioceses around us releasing lists probably helped inspire them to make that decision to release one.
So Tom Doyle, you spoke to Sarah in the process of producing this podcast, and one of the things that you told her is that it shouldn't, if you know what you're looking for, and they certainly know what they're looking for, doing this list shouldn't take so long.
Absolutely. I mean, this isn't, it doesn't take a genius to figure out what you're looking for. You're looking for any indication in a file, any report, any accusation of that nature. Secondly, whether the guys are priests or truck drivers, you know, an allegation of sexual abuse is a possible commission of a felony crime in the state of North Carolina and in every other state in the country. So rather than mess around with these review boards, and by the way, the Associated Press very recently published the results of an investigative deal on review boards, and the review boards didn't come out looking too well. My response to the question, you know, what should they do, is very simple. Call the police. Bishops and monsignors and other people they hire are not trained investigators.
Right.
That's ridiculous. The church cannot police itself. The very fact that we're discussing this is ample proof of that.
So former spokesperson for the Catholic Diocese, David Haynes, and we've referred to this before, told the Charlotte Observer in January of this year that the diocese wasn't convinced that there was empirical evidence, this is a quote, empirical evidence that publishing a list brings comfort or aid to the victims. Obviously, they changed their mind. Why?
Because there was a lot of pressure put on them. That's why.
And you've looked at lists, Sarah, from across the country.
I have.
What can we glean from those lists?
The lists are fascinating because there is no mandate as to what needs to be on a list. So every list is a little different. Some are very comprehensive. If you look at the Sacramento Diocese list, it has a page devoted to each person who's been accused, the number of victims that have come forward, and details about the accusations. And then you look at other lists, they don't have as much details.
Right.
So they are important not just for the people that live in that diocese, but also people like, for example, when the Richmond Diocese released their list about a year ago, there were a few people that had served at one point in the Charlotte Diocese. And would we have ever known about those accusations had another person not released their list? That's the question.
One of the criteria for making this list that the Charlotte Diocese is compiling right now and promising to release by the end of this year is that the names on that list will be those of people who have been, quote, credibly accused, end quote. They aren't the only diocese who have used that term. What does it mean, Tom Doyle, and why do they have the legal right to make that determination?
Number one, they don't have the legal right to make that determination. And it's a fluid term. It's a term that's determined essentially by the bishop, because the bishop is the sole real authority in the diocese. He can decide who goes on the list and who doesn't. There can be, you know, ample evidence from documents, police reports, etc., that an individual was, has been accused, and in some improbability actually committed the crimes or committed the acts. But the idea of credibly accused is mysterious, and a lot of us have been just trying to discuss this. There's no objective set of standards for what that means anywhere. It's something that's up to each diocese. And I have seen instances where the bishop has decided that this was not credibly accused. There was an outside investigation in the case and found that there's ample evidence. The individual was prosecuted, and things turned out to be quite a bit different. Let me just make one small remark on something that was said earlier, that there was no empirical evidence that these lists benefited the victim.
Yeah, that's a David Haynes quote, who former spokesman for the diocese here.
Wherever David got it, and if he cooked it up or whoever cooked it up, it's a ridiculous statement because there's absolutely no basis for it. It does have benefit for the victims, a lot of benefit for them.
You also did, and we only have a minute left in this segment, sir, but you did a podcast, an award-winning podcast, following a rape victim through the process and talking about the trauma of the actual incident and the trauma that she experienced during the whole process of trying to find justice for her crime. Is the story of abuse victims in this situation at all similar?
I think it is. There are a lot of differences between that case and this and these that we explore in the list, but there are so many overlying themes of survivors not feeling believed, not feeling heard. Another reason that we don't have a full extent as to how deeply this abuse runs is that we know that there is stigma and there is shame in coming forward with your story and feeling like you're going to be believed either by the church or law enforcement.
I have 20 seconds, Tom Doyle. These victims want justice. Does putting names on a list of perpetrators give them that justice?
It begins it. It's the beginning of a recognition that these guys actually did something, and it's a step up from the norm, the default, which was denial and massive denial about it,
right,
and vilification of the victim.
Tom Doyle is a former Catholic priest, former attorney in the Vatican Embassy, and an investigator about this subject. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about sexual abuse in the Catholic Church and the list that the Catholic Diocese of Charlotte is scheduled or has promised to release by the end of the year. One of the reasons, Sarah told me off the air, one of the reasons that it's taken so long is because they have hired a private professional investigative firm to do this, and they are not ready to release the list of those, quote, credibly accused, end quote. You tried to talk to them, too, and what happened?
We had a scheduled interview, and then the afternoon before the interview, they called to cancel it after talking to the diocese.
I want to be clear that we've invited members of the Catholic Diocese of Charlotte to be on this program, and they declined, citing scheduling conflicts. Jan on Twitter writes, as General Presbyter of the Presbytery of Charlotte, which would be the Presbyterian Church, misconduct in our congregations is addressed with transparency. We're constitutionally required to report all misconduct to police and remove the perpetrators. That is, as I understand it, from Father Winslow that you talked to, the policy now?
That is here. The policy now, currently.
Is that the policy, Tom Doyle, nationwide?
No. It goes diocese by diocese.
Why is that not the policy? Why hasn't the federal government stepped in here and said, it will be your policy, it will be our policy to come after you?
That's a good question. I think, practically speaking, when it's been discussed among those of us who are involved, it's this, the, you know, the size of the Catholic Church in this country. But I believe it is possible to do it. If the issue were looked at from a RICO standpoint as like organized crime, which is in a sense what it is, you know, there's been a systemic policy of cover-up until that was broken, and they can't sustain that any longer. Mm. But other countries, Australia being the one that I use as the best example, had an incredible 2-year investigation run by the government into all the private institutions into sexual abuse. And, of course, in their investigation, the Catholic Church came out with more dirt on its face, more victims, more perpetrators than all of the other institutions combined. And so some of their recommendations involved some pretty hard action by the government and demands on the part for the church as well.
In the course of producing this podcast, The List, you spoke to Charles Bigley, who is an abuse victim and who now runs the Raleigh chapter of SNAP, that is the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. And he told you what it meant, Sarah, to see the name of his abuser on a list.
Finally got some verification, if you will. Some people were saying, oh, no, not him. You know, I even had somebody call me and say, oh, he didn't abuse me, and I was an altar boy under him. And going like, you know, I never said he did everyone he met. We had probably in the vicinity of 200 people come forward, 200 other men that were abused as boys. He had a 45-year career raping young boys. So it brought so many men forward. Some said, you know, that I was the only one they've ever told, and you know, their wife doesn't know or their family doesn't know, but as long as they felt some validation that they could at least get some satisfaction from the knowledge that he was finally exposed. That's the only way you can stop these people, is to expose them. They don't stop on their own.
And that brings us to Anthony, and we're only going to use his first name at his request. Anthony alleges he was abused by a priest who at one time was at St. Anne here in Charlotte. He filed a civil lawsuit in 2011, but it was dismissed because the statute of limitations had run out. Anthony, thank you for talking with us. I appreciate it.
Good morning.
Good morning. Psychologist Charles Bailey just said that the only way to stop child sexual predators is to expose them. They don't stop on their own. And in your case, which is similar to many others I've heard, your abuser told you not to tell anyone. Did you tell anyone up until this point?
I didn't tell anybody until my early 20s.
What held you back?
I'm sorry, what was that?
What held you back?
Fear, embarrassment, pretty much just fear and embarrassment of what happened.
And he told
myself.
The priest that abused you, I think we played a little cut of you earlier in this program, he told you that he was doing what he was doing because he loved you, and that, quote, this is how God wants us to show each other that we love each other.
That's correct.
How old were you at the time?
I first met Farwell when I was about 14, and it continued until 17. He started with just, you know, inappropriate extended hugs, grinding on me, showering me with gifts, and then there was a time I stayed in the rectory when he had gotten transferred to Sacred Heart in Salisbury, and that's where he performed oral sex on me.
You mentioned the priest's name a moment ago, and I want to point out that although you have credible allegations against him, your case was dismissed because of the statute of limitations, so he was not convicted of the crimes you allege he perpetrated on you, but he was convicted of other crimes on other people. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Being the fact that in Rowan County that I had just turned 17 when he had done that, they dismissed my charges against him, and I don't understand why they would not have just file charges for statutory rape if it wasn't indecent liberties.
Your case is particularly heinous, it seems to me, because of the situation that resulted in your coming into contact with this priest. You had a troubled childhood. You ran away from home.
Correct.
Correct.
You hitchhiked to Chicago, at which time you were raped by a trucker on the way Chicago. And that, you never told your parents about that, but they could tell when you came back that something was very wrong, so they sent you to confession.
Yeah.
Okay, right. And this is where this priest came into contact with you in confession. And it was after you told him in confession what had happened that he began, in your words, grooming you. What does that mean?
Just starting to spend time with me, buying me gifts, calling me on the phone, spending time at the rectory. He would have me organize books and stuff. You know, I became an altar boy. He just because that was a great way to get out of class. You know, at St. Anne's.
Mm-hmm.
Just by trying to build up that trust.
How long did it take to build up that trust before he perpetrated the first act on you?
It was about a year and a half, maybe.
And how many times after that did it happen?
How many times after?
After the initial encounter, did it happen again?
Well, that was a one-time occurrence in Salisbury, but the grinding and the hugging, that was like on a weekly basis.
Why did you put yourself? This is a terrible question to ask somebody who's been a victim of this kind of thing, and who was also a minor at the time. But I'm going to ask the question anyway. Why didn't you remove yourself from that priest? Why keep going around?
I didn't realize what was happening at that young age.
Okay.
I just assumed it was he was just hugging, you know, he was just showing affection.
What would you tell some concerned parents to look for or look out for in kids? Because kids don't come forward necessarily, although they may be more prone to today than when you were 17 or 16 or 15 or 14. What should they look for in children?
Well, boys in particular don't want to come forward because it is not the norm of, a male-on-male encounter. I would say when they start to withdraw and have threats of suicide, you've definitely got to be looking into something because there's a reason behind it.
You told Sarah D'Elia that there is a reason that the church doesn't want to publish these lists, because if they do, people will see the names of priests and start coming forward. Were you speaking of the church in general or the Catholic diocese here in Charlotte in particular?
I was referring to the diocese here in Charlotte. However, it goes across the board for whatever institution, whether it be a school or a daycare or a church, by exposing the names of the people gives justification that, hey, all this time of what, you know, Tony said is just gives some type of validation that, yes, finally it's out there, you know, and then maybe other people will be brave enough to stand up and come forward as well.
Are there people you know from that time in your life who had a similar experience with that priest that have talked to you about it?
No, I went to Catholic school. Nobody really ever, that I know of, that I've discussed anything with. But I know when there's one and then there's two, that there's definitely more. It's just the pattern that they follow. They don't stop with just one or two people. Back in the day, those that went to Charlotte Catholic were a lot of the movers and shakers in Charlotte. People, you know, had money, influential people. So, you know, some of these people, because of their status, I'm sure that if something were to have happened, they would not have gone out to the media or to the police. They would have resolved that issue in-house.
Your case was dismissed because the statute of limitations had run out. Several states have removed or extended the statute of limitations on crimes of sexual abuse. In the case of minors, it seems to me, in case of minors by authority figures, this is even more important because children are not only reluctant to come forward at the time of the abuse, but also may be traumatized and are traumatized well into adulthood. How has this impacted your life?
It's definitely impacted my life very deeply. I've struggled. I had numerous suicide attempts. Financially, I was a pretty bright kid. I should have gone to college and done better with my life faster than where I've gotten today. Mm. It destroyed my first marriage. It's put a damper on my second marriage. My wife is very loving and supporting and understanding. It's put a strain on my family, friends that I grew up with.
Is this similar to some of the other things you've heard from other victims, Sarah, that you've spoken to in the course of this?
It is. I mean, I think that it depends on sort of the age of the victim. I think of Charles Bailey, who we heard of, who is the head of the Raleigh chapter of SNAP. And I know he is 68 now, and he didn't tell his wife about the abuse that he experienced until he was 52. Because by that point they had several children together. They had been married for about 30 years.
Yeah.
And that was finally when he was comfortable in talking to her about that.
And Tom Doyle, you've spoken to victims all over the country. I'm sure that this all of what you've just heard is nothing new to you. Maybe I don't know whether you can do this or not, because you're not a psychologist, but can you explain why there are such long-lasting repercussions from these acts on children by figures of authority?
Well, they're not just acts. The repercussions don't come just from figures of authority. If you're a child, a minor, anyone, if you're sexually violated, that's a tremendous violation. And I believe I can say that I think you to fully comprehend it, you have to have gone through it. But the research, there's been massive research done and massive data out there about the effects of sexual violation on children, minors, and so on.
So,
and it's just there.
So, Anthony, I have about a minute left. Although your lawsuit was unsuccessful, the priest that you accused was sent by the church to the House of Affirmation, a treatment center for priests with psychological and psychosexual problems, and was later permanently removed from ministry in 2002. Have you ever received anything from the church, an apology, money, offers to help with counseling, anything?
No, I've received nothing. They did at one point say that they would pay for counseling, but they wanted privy to those records, and I told them to go pound sand. the lay board never contacted me, so I don't know who their witnesses were. In addition, them saying that they reported stuff to social services, I was never contacted from anybody from social services.
Sarah, in episode one of the series, you ask who gets to decide if that priest that abused Anthony, if his name will go on the Charlotte list. Why the question, and what's the answer?
The question is the question that everyone wants the answer to, which is why I asked it. And the answer, I believe, would be the bishop is the one that ultimately the head of the church will get to make that decision.
So the Charlotte Diocese was invited to join us for this conversation, but were unable to do so. They cited, once again, scheduling conflicts. But they did pass along a statement saying that they have zero tolerance for any incidents of child sexual abuse, that they have removed all credibly accused clergy permanently from the ministry, that no one serving in the diocese today has a credible allegation against them. In 2002, U.S. bishops adopted something called the Charter for the Protection of Children and Young People, which spells out uniform protections and protocols for addressing allegations of child sexual abuse, and the diocese says those protocols are working. All allegations are now reported, they say, to law enforcement. Criminal background checks are done on all church workers and volunteers, over 60,000 to date. Ongoing training in this area is mandatory, they say, and to promote justice and healing for victims. The Charlotte Diocese is in the process of providing a comprehensive public accounting of clergy credibly accused of child sexual abuse. You can hear Sarah Dalia's four-part podcast, The List, by using whatever podcast aggregator you can. Sarah Dalia joined us along with former Catholic priest Thomas Doyle, former attorney in the Vatican Embassy, and an abuse victim named Anthony. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.